So there once was a quirky monarch who wanted to find the wisest person in the realm. And the monarch had the ministers gather up the three wisest people that could be found. And when they brought to the palace, had them march straight up to the highest tower of the dungeon. Dark room, no windows, many floors up. Marched them into this room and said, "You have 3 days to figure out how to get out. And if you don't get out in 3 days, it's off with your heads." And with that, the door closed, slammed shut. And on that door, the inside of the door, with the three wise people looking at the door, was this amazingly complex set of locks. Combination locks and key locks and locks the kind they'd never seen before. It was serious. It was a big, serious door. So the consequences of not finding their way out was pretty dire, pretty serious. So two of them went immediately to work. And got single-mindedly focused on those locks and tried to figure out how those locks works and tried all kinds of combinations. They worked and worked. But the third one just sat down opposite the door and leaned back against the wall and just napped, relaxed. Probably meditated a lot. And then, I was getting closer and closer to the deadline of 3 days, and the other twos were sweating. They hadn't figured out the locks yet. Sweating and trying to figure it out, and they got more and more one-pointed, like this is all that mattered. And I was getting close to the deadline. The third one stood up finally, and walked over to the door and pushed on it, and it opened. There were certainly a lot of locks on the door, but the door itself had never been locked. They had never tried opening a door directly. They were caught up with the idea of locks. Their first assumption about that this was going to be hard to get out, and there's all these locks and all these things to fix and take care of. And the other one, the third, the wisest one, just kind of rested and meditated, maybe until some clarity arose what to do. So sometimes we're asked to sit quietly and relax in our dungeons. We probably all have our dungeons. And if you run around, single-mindedly focusing on the locks, you might be not paying attention to the big picture. And maybe by learning to relax deeply, to be at ease in your life you have, to learn not to be reactive and caught up, attached and desperate, there's a chance to maybe see something you can't see otherwise. And so the cliche in our circles, as you've probably heard this before, but if you want to go forward, retreat. So we go on retreat so we can go forward. So we sit here. Here we are. And it's kind of often for many people counterintuitive or goes against all their beliefs to sit and do nothing. But we're not really doing nothing. It's one of the most profound things we can do, to do what we're doing here. But it is counterintuitive. It's not the usual way of fixing things, the usual way of approaching them directly, or the other usual way, which is escaping, denying, covering over, pretending it's not, taking a sledgehammer to, making someone else responsible for it. So all these things that we do, which don't really work, they're all kind of combination locks that no one knows really the combination of those locks. But there's a time and place to try something, a different approach. And that is the approach of the heart. And the approach that helps the heart, or if you like, prefer the word mind, become whole, wholehearted or one-hearted, one-minded, with the idea that if we're scattered and fragmented and distracted, that we can't really be whole. We can't really have one heart if we close off parts of ourselves. Then the heart can't be whole. If we ignore parts of ourselves, if we are attacking parts of ourselves, it's not so uncommon for people to be at war with themselves. We have things about ourselves that don't fit our idea of how we're supposed to be. And so one approach is to reject and be angry at that part of ourselves. But then the part of ourselves that receives that anger doesn't like it, doesn't feel good. And so sometimes it rebels against the part that wants it to be just right. And so it goes back and forth, and there's no winning that kind of war. And so we're divided. So the counterintuitive way is to do, in a certain kind of way, do nothing except pay attention. Pay careful attention. Give the kind of attention that has space for it all, that holds it all. Give the kind of attention to our lives that is not in conflict with what is. The kind of attention that takes down the walls. The image that someone taught me recently was kind of that of like a lighthouse that has, you know, at the top of the lighthouse is all glass. And there's a, you know, big flashlight on a swivel, goes around and around. And but if there's curtains around the glass all the way around, 360 degrees, the light doesn't go out. But if you open the curtain on the lighthouse a foot or so, an inch or so, then a little bit of light goes out in a certain direction. But if you pull the curtain further, more light goes out. If you pull it 90 degrees up from where you started, you have light going out 90 degree angle. Pull the curtain further around 180 degrees, you have light going one half of the circle. And if you pull the curtain around 360 degrees, it shines everywhere. So it is with our hearts, or our minds, or our awareness. It's a certain kind of 360 degrees is possible. So we learn to open that attention and include everything. And it's one of the big tasks of, I think, any life of freedom, is to develop a capacity of heart, of mind, that can hold everything, that includes everything in it. It's not the same thing as saying yes to everything, agreeing to everything, or just going along with everything. There's certain things we say no to, and there's some things we change. But at least when in meditation itself, we start there, that's a place where we don't have to change anything. That's a place where we learn how to have the heart include everything. Even if you're okay with this kind of split, divide. Even though the mind might have to figure out sometimes that we have to do things, the heart holds it all. Yeah. So how do we, that's a task, how do we do that heart thing? How do we do the part of awareness that opens and it can hold everything peacefully and have confidence in that peaceful place, begin ease with things and hold it all and still be able to take care of the world and use our common sense, our best sense to know what to say yes to, what to say no to, what to fix, what to leave alone. But it's a lot easier to know how to respond to the world, deal with it, if the heart knows how to be at peace with it all, to be open, to hold it all. Awareness can hold it all peacefully and at ease. So we sit in our dungeons, and the first task is to relax in the dungeon of our suffering and our challenges and troubles. To be willing to sit there and feel it and be with it and not be in a hurry. Solving is not the way to solve it. Because solving it too quickly is kind of avoiding it or avoid kind of opening and feeling and being present in a big way. Someone inherited, they got someone's will and it said, "You have inherited my treasure. I have this treasure chest. I'm not going to tell you exactly where it is, but it's on this plot of land." The person goes to the plot of land, looks everywhere, digs everywhere, doesn't find anything. But there's a pond on this land. Oh, maybe it has something to do with a pond. So the person takes a big stick and stirs, looks, tries, pokes around in the pond, and all that does is stir up the mud and you can't see. Then the person thinks, no, maybe I can sell the water. Maybe the water is the great thing. And so drains all the water, sells it, but it just dries out. Nothing happens. Or maybe I'm supposed to save the water. But then it just runs over the banks and floods the towns and villages. Maybe I'm supposed to... The water's so flat and nice. Maybe I get watercolors and paint on it. But that quickly shows that painting on the water doesn't really work. Water paint just kind of drifts off. So finally the person just kind of sits at the edge of the pond and leaves it alone. Doesn't do anything with it or fix it or do anything with it. And lo and behold, the story I told earlier, the mud settles. And only when the mud settles and the water is clear can he see that, then he can really see that the treasure was there, the bottom of the pond. I don't know where it was when he drained it, but that's besides that. You know, right? These are magical stories. So sometimes you have to leave the heart alone and let it settle. Find a place to become peaceful or at ease. And it's counterintuitive. You want to fix and do and make money and have projects and become famous or at least, you know, or something. Win your parents' approval. But sometimes you kind of stop stirring the mud. Stop trying to do, and just sit. And so on this retreat, we've been focusing on the five jhanic factors, the five factors of absorption. There's many ways of talking about these, but one we've tried to say is that these are ordinary factors of mind, of heart. These are just ordinary. They're present in some way or other much of the time, but we don't recognize them. But these are five factors of the mind or heart which come into play as we become peaceful, as we settle in, become centered, get collected. The curtain gets pulled 360 degrees and we're just here. This idea of just being here, Some of you know all too well that I like very much the little practice of saying here. And I use it on two different occasions. When I'm meditating and my mind is really out of control and I just can't seem to get a quarter breath of attention, you know, my mind just like, you know, just racing along. Then I'll say the word here, H-E-R-E, very generously, very kindly, not like your command to a dog. And I'll say here, just here I am. And in that saying here, I just take a moment to feel, sense, see, what is here? What's this like? And that, when my mind's out of control, it's like, here is a mind that's out of control. This is what it's like. And it's like here, it's like, it's okay to be this way. It's okay to have a mind that's out of control. It's okay to be jabbering away. But this is what it's like. And I have to say it repeatedly because that here, kind of is, it's like relaxing and opening up to feel what's here. Receive it, to be with it. Allow it. But because I'm jabbering away, it doesn't last more than a second. But then I do it again. Here. And if I do that for a while, here, it's like I'm being present for this, being present for this. Then with time, my jabbering mind quiets down. And when it quiets down, then I stop doing the here thing. But the second time, second instance or circumstance I say to myself here, is when I'm very settled, present, somewhat concentrated. It's very simple. My mind has gotten quiet. I'm really simple and present in a very ordinary but very full way. And then I'll say here, but then the here is kind of like a celebration. It's kind of like here, wow. Here, alive and present, that just the experience of being alive from the inside out, not from the mind down, but from the inside out, from the torso, and the experience of being alive here. Not being distracted, when my not caught up in the hindrances, not kind of wandering off a lot, a little bit, mind's drifting off a little bit perhaps, but not very strongly. And just to have that word here to remind myself, wow, here. Here. To be here. To really be here. Some people, turns out they're never here. They never have any experience of knowing how to really be here. It's always moving and moving and reacting and wanting, always remembering the past. At the risk of telling you a story that I've said too many times, it was a very powerful story, event that happened for me as a teacher. I was teaching a retreat at a Catholic retreat center, and it had a certain Catholic kind of monastery ambiance. And we had this morning meditation, 10 o'clock in the morning, with this, it was November, and this time of year, and light was coming in through the windows, and it was just very beautiful light, and something magical about that sitting. I think everyone felt it. It was like everything got peaceful, quiet, this clarity in the room with the light coming in, and like you could see the peace almost. And it was so still. So right after that meditation session, as a teacher, I went to my little room, this monastic cell, which I love. I kind of, one of my favorite little rooms, and, you know, because of my quirkiness. I said, this is a good room to die in, is what I used to think. When it's my time to die, I think I'd like to die here. See, I can be quirky too. And so I was sitting in my little room with my chair, and the first person who came to see me was a woman who was very troubled. I'd known her for several years, and very, very troubled, and lots of inner conflict and turmoil, and a lot of stories about all the injustices, all the problems of her life, and all the battles she's been had fought, and trouble she had, and certainly a lot of sad stories. I felt for her, but she was caught in the grip of them, like the wise people who are caught by the locks, fixing the locks that weren't needed. And she came in after this magical meditation, and it was clear that she also had been touched by the peacefulness of that morning. And she came in really peaceful. I'd never seen her this way. A little bit radiant, very peaceful. It was so still and peaceful, even in our room sitting there, that both of us didn't want to talk for a while. Just sat there. I thought, that's just quite remarkable given her background. And I don't remember exactly how we started talking. We might have commented about how nice it was and how still it was and how great it was. That was good to do. And then she said, yes, but it was not this way yesterday. Yesterday it was, and then it was like she got, I watched her pull out of her past, out of her memory, yesterday. And as she pulled yesterday into today, she became all gnarled and twisted and tight, and it was quite something to see the transformation. And I thought, well, how sad. Why did we have to bring yesterday into today? Yesterday can stay with yesterday. Can't we just be with today? A little, maybe a detour in the talk. I think the shortest Dharma talk I've ever heard of, given, I never heard it, but I heard about it. Suzuki Roshi gave a Dharma talk that went like this. And I think he did it because there was a Japanese priest in the audience who didn't want to give a Dharma talk because he didn't know enough English. So I think Suzuki Roshi wanted to demonstrate you don't know much, you don't have to have much English to give a good Dharma talk. So this is the talk. Today is today. Yesterday is yesterday. Tomorrow is tomorrow. Tomorrow is not today. Yesterday is not today. Today is today. There we go. Should I stop now? So today is today. So somehow, sit here and to trust deeply. It's a really powerful act of trust to what we're doing here. And it's not easy, not easy whatsoever to have the trust that it's okay just to let go and be here in a relaxed, full way. So these jhanic factors are these processes of how to do that. And it's a process of relaxing more deeply. As I've said earlier in the retreat, it's not about becoming one-pointed in a tight, tense way. But rather it's becoming wholehearted in a relaxed way, to open up, to settle into, or ease. So there's a lot of relaxation. A lot of letting go in getting concentrated. In fact, probably letting go is much more important to get concentrated than any act of concentrating. Letting go of the hindrances, letting go of the distractions, letting go of the tension. It's really one of the secrets, open secrets of the Buddhist life is the tremendous value of being relaxed. And partly because if we're tense, tension is like a factory for reactivity. Tension is a factory for more discursive thought. Tension is a factory for more kind of spinning off in our mind. And so if we don't relax physically and heartfully and mindfully, it's very hard to deal with the busy mind, the active mind, because the factory for it is still there. So, can you just relax? So these dhyanic factors have a lot to do with this. You know, it has a lot to do, supported by relaxation, supported by ease. So that's where it's, you know, so then the, and so we've covered four so far. There's these two things of connecting and then hanging out, connecting and sustaining, connecting and holding the experience, being with it. And then there's joy and happiness, or well-being and happiness, or contentment, these experiences of well-being. And partly it comes from being wholehearted, wholeheartedly involved with what you're doing, giving yourself over to something. And not in the single way that's tense. The two wise people who were trying so hard with the lock, they were tense in their focus, so they couldn't really see. But to be single-minded in a relaxed way is to not be blinded, but to be all your faculties, like 360 degrees open to hear, to this. To be completely open to the experience of what we have. And there's something about the complete giving over to an experience in a relaxed way, which evokes in us a certain sense of vitality or life that comes with a sense of well-being. And the analogy, one analogy I like to kind of use for it is that if you make a really hard fist, hold it for some time, and so much that it hurts and your knuckles go white and stuff, and then if you release your hand for a few seconds, you feel all this wonderful, maybe it's because the blood is flowing into your hands or something, or feel the release, the joy, the delight, your hand's kind of singing. Feels so good in my hands now to have this, you know, release of this tension. There's this joy or this kind of vitality that comes in the hands from that release. So the same thing, if we don't get concentrated in practice, we don't settle in to just be fully here without some kind of letting go of tension and holding, the hindrances that Max talked about. And as they get released, there's a release of energy, of vitality, of fullness here that begins to well up and feel good. Remember I told you to talk about the analogy for this first factor of joy, that the Buddha had the analogy of an upwelling spring in a lake. So this upwelling from inside, that happens. And then at some point, because this relaxing goes on, this quieting, stilling process, turns out that as the curtains get pulled more and more, everything goes quieter, gets stiller. And as it gets stiller, the flow of the spring in the lake quiets down. And there's no more flowing, and just a very refreshing pond that's completely still. But it's very refreshing. I think maybe the analogy should be, you should think about in India, it being a very hot, very, very hot in India sometimes. And so to be able to go into a refreshing, cool lake in India is like nirvana. It's like really great. And to be able to go and for people, you know, for people who have the particular condition of having to speak English, maybe warm water is more inviting, because, you know, England's a cold place, and so the English, that metaphors in England are, in English are, you know, to be cool in England, English is, you know, you can be cool, but sometimes cool and being chilled is a good thing, but she gave me the cold shoulder. But to the metaphor of a cool, refreshing in a hot climate, to get into it and just completely still water, and just lay there and you float in it, and your every part of your body is touched by this refreshing coolness of the water, is the analogy the Buddha gave for this state. It's kind of all-encompassing, like. And the experience of this is, again, the curtains have been pulled, and we're open, we're including everything. There's no resistance to anything. And it's quite remarkable that the human heart, the mind, has this capacity to settle this far, to quiet this far. And I know it's not easy. I know there's, you know, many of us are involved in our jabbering and our concerns and our struggles, many of them which are very real and important. Those are really important parts of life to practice with and to include. But how do we open to those? How do we open to our struggles? How do we open to our challenges? So that in the opening to them, there is a willingness to hold it with vitakka and vichara. Willingness, a kind of well-being, a kind of willingness. In the willingness, there's a kind of well-being. The willingness is kind of feeling of rightness. I was certainly very surprised in my early years of practice to discover that some of my suffering that I had that seemed pretty heavy and weighed me down, difficult to be with, that if I could open to it in a certain way, the suffering didn't go away, but together with the suffering was a certain feeling of rightness, certain feeling of certain kind of, I don't know if well-being is the right word, of rightness is the word I used for myself back then. Rightness, it felt right. Things were right when I could open to them. In the opening, the willingness, there was something that felt right. Good. So it was kind of odd that you both, what? They can, these two things can exist together? I can, you know, my suffering? Me suffering and it's, you know, a sense of rightness or joy or well-being, just hold it that way. So even though these jhanic factors point to this, you know, deep meditative experience of really being settled, they're relevant in all our situations. How do we open to it? So this deeper well-being, or a certain kind of stillness, the happiness of stillness, the happiness of not being caught, the happiness of being open, available, receptive to this. So then the fifth jhanic factor is usually translated into English as one-pointedness. And I've never made my peace with that choice, of the translation choice. Other people have, so maybe it's a good word for some people. But I've never made my peace with that. I prefer better than one-pointedness is single-mindedness. If single-mindedness doesn't mean tunnel vision, you know, tunneling, it means single kind of one mind, sitting with one mind, a whole mind, one heart, whole heart, wholeheartedness, one-mindedness and wholeheartedness are basically synonyms for me. So that single-mindedness and wholeheartedness. And so it means, you know, that whatever we're doing, we give ourselves fully to. We're wholeheartedly there. It's like, oh, we're there for that thing. We offer it our whole being. And this is something I learned a lot about from in my Zen training. Because in the Zen, it was actually part of the training, you know, how they were Zen life, monastic life was like a dance. It was choreographed. You came to the monastery, you were told how to do the dance. So you had to do all these, very particular way you had to do things. So, for example, if I was going to, this literally happened to me, if I was going to pick up a pot, like a pot of rice, you know, you pick up, you know, what's the big deal? You do it simply, no big deal, don't think about it, don't make any special effort, you know, just grab the pot of rice, you know, and carry it around. If you're going to do something, you do it wholeheartedly. Respect, also in the Zen, with respect, you give yourself completely to it. Like you want to, like almost like you want to become one with it. Like you are the thing you're doing. You are the thing. So you don't just pick it up casually. Hey, Max, you know, like, you know, you want some rice? you, I went into the kitchen in the monastery to talk to the cook, and he was chopping vegetables at night in the evening. It was after evening zazen meditation. I don't know what he was chopping vegetables or something. And I asked him a question. I think it was a good question. So he put down his knife, stood up, and answered me. Picked up his knife, started chopping again. So I asked him another question. He put down the knife and answered my question. Picked up his knife, started chopping again. So I asked him another question, because I was kind of clueless to what was going on. And so then, after my third question, he put down his knife, and he said, "Gil, I'm only going to do one thing at a time. You know, right now I'm chopping the vegetables. So if he kind of pointed out what was going on, I hadn't noticed. So I said, "Oh, okay." So I let him just chop his vegetable. So with the pot, you know, so the way with a pot is you want to pick it up with both hands and hold it with both hands. And actually, people said, as if you're picking up the head of the Buddha, you know. You just hold it, you know. So there's respect. You're giving, you're fully in it. You're with, all of you is part of it, what you're doing. That's wholehearted. You're there for that experience. So I was very disappointed when I went to Zen Center some years later, and one of the senior priests was having breakfast, reading the newspaper. What? What? So I said to him, "What's going on?" And he said, "When you're having breakfast and reading the newspaper, just have breakfast and read the newspaper." So this wholeheartedness, you know, just, so what does it look like when you meditate, when you do walking meditation? To give yourself over wholeheartedly. It's also, wholehearted to me means it's a physical act. It's not just a mind thing. It's a physical act. It's like that's why some of you know, I like to translate the word samadhi by the English word composure. Because you tell someone to compose themselves, and it's something you do with your body first and foremost. Like, compose your body and get yourself kind of sit up straighter or get more balanced or something. And so it's a physical act. And so this samadhi thing of developing concentration, to me, is a very physical thing. And I didn't always know that. I thought it was the laser and the control tower. I was supposed to direct and hold it. But it's more like taking my whole being and being wholehearted with it, just there with it. So my breath, just really there. Just everything kind of composes or organizes around the breath. So the breath is at the center, but everything's organized around it. Or if I'm doing walking, everything's centered around walking, but in a composed way. There have been times when I did walking meditation when I used to be in the constant, in the laser pointing school. I would bend over like this to look at my feet as I walked. You know, as if I could be more focused if I could see my feet. And it turned out that I actually could be more composed and more in the walking in my feet if I stood up straight and balanced and just kind of was really there and didn't look at my feet. Just there. To be composed. Wholehearted. So this thing about becoming single-minded or one-pointed or fully composed or settled on the experience, it's the mind that's not distracted, but it's also a mind that's effortlessly right there. When the mind is effortlessly one-pointed or effortlessly single-minded, it's like if you have a bowl, big bowl, and you put a marble and have it spin, you drop it in from the side, it goes up and down and up and down because of momentum. But as it kind of slows down, gets quieter and calmer, it comes to rest at the bottom of the bowl, and at the center. So with this one-pointedness, single-mindedness, that state of being fully there for whatever we're really here, it's like we're resting at the bottom of the bowl. And there's very little effort that's needed in meditation at this point, when it's really strong, just there, here. The mind is not going off, just there, here. And as we're getting close to this area where I like to say to myself, here. Here. And if this idea of kind of, if you use the word one-pointedness, one-pointed attention on the breath, if it has a location, that sense of one-pointedness, for me, and this is my quirkiness, right? But it's certainly not the laser in the head in the control tower. It's a physical feeling of intentness that I have in my torso. Deep down in my torso. It's kind of being intent. I'm just there in an intent but quiet, peaceful way. Just here. I'm here. So this is a possibility for all of us. To know that this is possible, to have a certain kind of stability and just settling, being really settled here. Here we are. And to know that it's a way forward. It's a way to be settled and relaxed, that we can and see 360, be open all the way around, that we can see our life in a whole different way. You can see total different things. It's not uncommon for people to come to a retreat and say, I have this big issue that I want to deal with. You know, I have to decide whether I should take a job or not, or this job or that job, or should I quit my job, or, you know, some big question. And it's a reasonable thing to come and retreat to kind of address these, but inevitably what I'll tell them is that what I advise them is don't think about your big question for the first 6 days of the retreat. Because if you don't think about it and just do the practice, you'll be in a much better circumstance to have an answer after the 6 days of practice. Trust the process and you'll be in a new place, and then see where you're at. You'll have a different reference point for it. You'll have a different way of appreciating what your priorities and what's really important for you, what your values are. When it's more total, the totality of who we are, more relaxed and settled for ourselves. So, you know, we do this counterintuitive thing of being willing to let go and to settle, discover what it's like to be here. And then it gives us a different eyes that we can see more clearly than we could before. The mud settles, and there's treasure to be found. So I talked earlier about these concentric circles of attention. And, you know, at different times we have to expand and contract, open, and bring closer in the concentric circle. Sometimes we're sitting and we're very quiet and peaceful, and it feels like we're very intimate. And if anything, the concentric circles are very close in. And other times, it could be that suddenly you're minding your own business, and Tom uses a jackhammer outside because of the whatever's happening out there, and his jackhammer is pounding away. And I sat in a small cabin and cut in Thailand for a 1 month retreat, solo retreat, and it was in the edge of a farmer's field. And one day I heard a tractor far in the distance. It sounded like a tractor. And it came closer and closer and closer and closer and closer. And as it came closer, it was all day, half the day to get closer. And then when I was right behind, only a few feet behind my little, my whole cabin was shaking, shaking, shaking. It was shaking and shaking, and then slowly it shook less and less, and then it went receding the rest of the day to go the other direction. Mm-hmm. And the farmer was digging a trench on the edge of the property. So all kinds of things can happen in retreat centers. So when Tom starts a jackhammer out there, then you might have to open your concentric circle wider. Wide enough to include your reactivity, your irritation, your desperation for something different, your plans to go to another retreat center, your memories of, you know, of all kinds of things. Your mind goes all kinds of places. You have to open up your circles wide, wide, wide. And if you're lucky, you make your circle so wide that it's way wider than all the reactivity and thoughts you have. It's so wide that it's wider than the property. Your awareness is so big and wide that the jackhammering is just one piece of this big, big circle. So we have to learn how to be, you know, flexible and go, you know, move different times, you know, and retreat. But overall, the movement, I think, for going to a retreat is we start maybe very wide. We have to accept all our busyness and quirkiness and issues that are there and unresolved things and energy and momentum of our life. And we have to learn how to hold it. And slowly, maybe it begins to settle somewhat. And we become more intimate and closer in at times. But then at some point, we have to go back out into the world. And then I have to be willing to open up and think of the concentric circles going out and include something wider. And to be fluid in this movement of the circles. Now, one thing about a circle is a circle has a center. And in a peculiar way, the center of any circle that you're in, guess who's there? You. Right? If you're the center of your awareness and you go out, you know, and you have to, sometimes you're close in and just right here, and sometimes you have to include everything in the room, the building, the valley, the state. But you know, you're always at the center. And we say in English, we have this expression in English about someone being self-centered as being kind of a synonym of being conceited. But if you're other-centered, that can be dangerous. Not in touch with yourself, you don't know what's happening to you. The issue of boundaries is often a problem when someone doesn't have a good sense of who they are and touch with themselves. Be other-centered, always concerned about other people, is a problem. The opportunity of mindfulness practice is not to be self-centered, but to be situation-centered. To be centered in any situation you're in. And it just happens that you're the center, but you don't have to be self-centered. It's just that you center yourself in the situation. And it happens to be that that situation, the very core, the point center of that of the situation, as it goes out, has to travel out through these bones and nerves and flesh and brains and hearts, and has to go out through all this stuff. And then it can go out beyond it and become aware of what's beyond further. That every situation includes you, but not in a self-centered way, but it includes you. So the idea is you want to become aware, fully aware of what's here. If you want to be aware of the situation, you always want to be aware here. In fact, you want to try to be aware through this with all your faculties. And so you know what you're thinking. You know what you're feeling. You know the impact that the world around you has on you. You know what you believe. You know the sensations of your body and places you get tight when someone speaks to you, or the ways you soften up and relax. All this information is there. You're in touch with it. I love the expression, you're in touch with it. It's all important, but not in a self-centered way. Almost as if you're as important as anyone else. We're all equally important. But it just happens the person closest to you is this one here. And you're important. And your ability to be at ease, your ability to be whole, your ability to count as one, is really important for your capacity to take care of everyone else, or take care of the world, or what situation out there. If you don't take care of yourself, you can't take care of others. If you sacrifice yourself too much in the wrong way, you can't really help others. So situation-centered, this mindfulness practice, is this one-pointedness, this single-mindedness, this intentness associated with being really, in some ways, rooted here, to abide here, to dwell here, to be here. Be willing to be at rest here, in your body, in this situation. My first sense that I discovered that I that I was not in my, sometimes I was not in my body, was when I studied in Thailand with a teacher named Buddhadasa, Ajahn Buddhadasa. And he said, don't do anything that takes you out of your body. And I thought that was strange. What? So I was so strange, it was so strange, that I started paying attention to what I was doing with my body. And it finally clicked to me what he was talking about. When we only had one meal, big meal a day, little breakfast and a big meal at lunchtime. So lunch was very important. And it was time to walk from the meditation hall across the big monastery to the dining hall to have lunch. And I discovered that I was ahead of my body. It was like, you know, it was kind of like leaning forward to get to lunch. Lunch was so important. It was like, but my sense of gravity, my sense of presence was like ahead of me, like going ahead. And I said, wait a minute, I could come back. And I was able to, you know, reel it in and walk this way and be here. And probably lasted half a second before. It was a big fish, right? So it pulled me out to reel it back in. So to be situation-centered. And then from that situation-centered, to have sense of these concentric circles. And sometimes your concentric circle includes another person. But you don't make that person the center. You don't lose yourself. You don't step outside of the circle, and that's the circle now, that person. That's the only person that counts. But rather, you include that person in your circle. And then you include, at other times, many people, the whole world. Some of you know Sharon Salzberg's title of her book, A Heart as Wide as the World. A Heart as Wide as the World. So this idea of one-heartedness, one-mindedness, single-mindedness, one-pointedness is partly to be, you feel a certain ease, relaxation in being settled on this point here, one-pointedness, this center here. Here. And then the awareness, the heart can be open widely to include everything. And that's the koan. That's the great question to discover in life. What is it like for you in your quirkiness? For those of you who are quirky, I don't want to assume, you know. In your quirkiness, what is it like for you in your quirkiness, your way, your particular way you're constituted? What is it like for you to be at ease in all circumstances, to be at ease and have an attention and awareness that is can be open and receptive to it all, that doesn't close down, react, get excited, alarmed? What is it like? What's it like to open up? What do you have to open up to? Maybe, see, the last thing I'll say is, so you don't get the wrong idea from me. You might not ever be able to do it perfectly. So what's it like to be open and relaxed and settled here, have open to everything, where everything has to include how you can't open to some things, how some things you still get caught by and reacted to? That's the koan. How do you open to everything where everything includes not opening to everything? I think that's realistic. So wholeheartedness, single-mindedness in the sense of one heart, undivided mind. So let's take a few moments to sit again and